Round, round, get around. Look who's back.
What's up, my man?
Look who's expecting.
Oh, right! Lay one on me.
That's your baby sister, Julie, in there. She's kicking.
Now, wait a minute. Let me get this straight. My little sister is in my juice cup?
TriStar Pictures presents...
Mikey, this is your sister, Julie.
Hiya, Julie. Welcome to the outside. I'm going to be in charge of your life for the next 2 or 3 years. Smacking you around, getting you in shape. Anything you need, don't be afraid to ask.
Who is this slime ball?
Look who's talking to.
And welcome to Unloved Sequels, the podcast that brings you a blow-by-blow critique of Hollywood's worst-rated sequels. You know, the ones some people think should never have been made. We're your hosts. Michael, say hello.
Hello.
And I'm Claire. In this episode, we're wading through more dream sequences than you can shake a diaper bag at in pursuit of domestic bliss. Michael, what's the movie?
So, Mikey is back, but this time he's not alone. This time he has his baby sister, Julie, a bunch of playgroup friends, all along for the ride to help him navigate siblinghood, delinquent parents, overbearing grandparents, layabout uncles, their mum's horny best friend, and a dreaded potty training, all come together with this super thin plot even a newborn could get his head around. This is Look Who's Talking To.
I mean, I feel like you've basically just summarised my life, but...
Yeah. Yeah, I did think when I'm picking this movie that you could
relate to.
Who knew
they made a movie?
About your life.
About my life. I did find it quite relatable, actually, both of these movies.
I know. But before we get started on the movie, Claire, did you have a good Christmas and a good New Year?
I did, thank you. Yes, did you?
I did. It was nice to have a little break and it was nice to gather our thoughts, and we've got together our heads together and we've planned a really jam-packed year for you guys, so
we have.
We've got a full
schedule.
Yes,
it was nice to have the break, yes. But it's nice to be back as well, isn't it?
It is. It feels weird though. It does feel weird, like watching a movie and taking notes. I've watched like Home Alone, and I was like, "Well, I've got to make notes for this." No, I haven't. And it's just weird watching
a
film that
just watching a movie and just enjoying it and just not having to pick holes in it is quite refreshing.
It is. You can just let it
we
go
should do
over
it more
your
often.
Head. Exactly. And it was nice to watch something without a two or a three after the title. So that was quite a nice break.
Yeah. We can watch some original movies. So exciting.
I think our husbands were relieved, but thank God we can watch something that isn't dreadful. And we can get past this year. But
yes,
guys,
every now and then he does
it.
Say to me, could you not have just picked a concept that involved watching good movies?
There's too many competition out there for those kind of things. That's a problem.
I know. We found our niche.
It has. So, back to Look Who's Talking To. So, Look Who's Talking To was released on the 14th of December 1990 in the US and Canada, and then released in the UK on the 22nd of March 1991. So, it's back to those old days when you didn't have the internet and the world was a much bigger place and they could... divide up release dates by 6 to 7 months.
Yeah, that's a really... It's not like, oh, it's coming out a few weeks later in the UK. This is months.
But back then, that's how it used to be, because I remember my friends at... when I was at primary school, my friends go to America, they're going, oh, I went to the movies and seen this. I'm like, oh my God, you saw that like 8 months before we can see it. It was such a big thing that America got stuff before England did. And not like now, when everything just comes out, because I suppose they send films out digitally now compared to when they had to because back in them days, they printed movies onto reels of film. So to save money on distribution, they used to let America use the movies and the rolls of film. And then when those cinemas were finished with it, ship them off to foreign countries to use the same films. So they didn't have to produce hundreds and hundreds of thousands of the same thing. So it was kind of a way of them saving money. But you can't do that these days because the internet makes the world a smaller place. So they've got to get it out and about. So today we're looking at Look Who's Talking To, like I said, but it's a bit of a weird conversation because I'm going to go back and jumping backwards and forwards and talking about Look Who's Talking. Now, these titles are very familiar, so I'm going to get through these figures and this conversation piece, and then Claire's going to ask me questions if anybody might be confused. Normally, Claire. So
basically, I've been told to keep my gob shut for a little while.
She has, she has. So it went on to make $120.9 million. Well, for a comedy back in the 90s, that's not bad, you know? I couldn't find a budget anywhere online for this movie, so I decided to go back and look at Look Who's Talking, the original movie, to kind of like get a gist where the marketplace was. So Look Who's Talking was made for $7.5 million. Small budget, but quite a big budget for back in them days for a comedy. But I think a majority of that went to Kirstie Alley and John Travolta, if you're looking at kind of like star power. But Look Who's Talking went on to be a huge, massive success for the studio and took $297 million. So I imagine them going back to address the sequel and giving it a lot of budget, a lot of advertising. So I imagine kind of like the budget being roughly in the same ballpark to being like nearly double the amount of the original movie. You can tell by the puppetry in this movie and the voice cameos that they've obviously had a bit more budget to play with than the original movie.
Yes.
So, because the original movie is kind of like bare bones and this movie's got like demon puppets.
Yeah, they ran with that puppetry budget, didn't they?
Oh, they did, they did, they did. But comparing the box office gross of the original to this one, massive loss of $176.1 million in box office turnout from the sequel to the original. And these movies really came out like 14 months apart. So,
yeah,
you would think the demand would be higher. The world would be still talking about the first movie. So,
yeah,
for them to suddenly go, shit, that's a massive downfall. Like you would think like half of it or three quarters of the amount. But literally to lose that much of a turnover. We still got a third one, what we're hoping to discuss in a future episode.
We originally were
going to discuss it in this episode, and then I did some research and then watched a bit of it and realized this is a Christmas movie, probably not the best time to cover a Christmas movie directly after Christmas. So we went back and did
saying is we're going to be covering this in December this year.
Well, it depends what we'll
put it in your diaries, folks. It's gonna be a cracker.
After me giving you those figures, do you have any questions about figures? Do you understand where I'm coming from with, like, budget-wise?
I think so. Budget. It sounds like it's weird that that information isn't out there because it's usually quite readily available for films made in this period. Usually when you can't find the budget information, it's because it's a straight-to-video, which this really wasn't. So it's weird, but it is what it is. If the information isn't out there, there's not much more we can do with it than that, really.
So we can just assume that they're not going to release a movie, greenlit it immediately for a sequel and then not give it the same budget or give it more budget. Obviously,
it must have had more budget.
Oh, it must have.
Well, and everyone involved would have had more pulling power as well. I realise they were all contracted to do the sequel, but they would have been in a position off the back of the first one to negotiate a higher salary. And then... Yes. The cast has expanded so much as well. It's a much bigger cast in the second movie because you've got almost everyone from the first movie and then a bunch of extra people. So it would have cost more. And then, as you say, the effects budget will have been much higher because there's a lot more puppetry work. And the puppetry that we saw, the animatronic fetus, for example, is much more sophisticated in the second movie than in the first one. So clearly there was more money spent on this film.
Actually, interior of airplane shots there was. And you can't really just shoot inside an airplane. You've got to build an open cockpit and then shoot from inside of it. So they've had to build cockpit for that little scene.
Yes, they'll have had to have replicated the cockpit. I mean, the plane itself won't have been a huge cost to them because it was John Travolta's plane. But they'd have had to have replicated the cockpit because, as you say, they wouldn't have been able to film those angles from inside an actual Learjet cockpit. They would have had to have built a replica and then put in slots for cameras and such. So, it would have cost, it definitely would have cost more.
Definitely, definitely. I'm not going to go through the 1990 chart because I think it's pretty unfair when this movie came out in the first week in December and then didn't get an international release until the following year.
Yes. Yeah, it's going to be skewed, isn't it? So
yeah, because
which is a shame, because I would like to hear that chart, but I guess there'll be another opportunity to go through.
Yeah, we'll probably definitely cover 1990 again. Have we not? No, Ghostbusters 2 was 1989, wasn't it?
So, 89, yeah.
But this ended at the end of chart, ended at number 24 for the year in the worldwide, what was only the US and Canada takings. So it's not bad, seeing that it's only had 3 weeks and it's only the North America and Canada amount of money.
Well, my guess is that people, certainly in North America and Canada, where it had its initial release, will have rushed to see it because it's the sequel to a massively popular movie. But then by the time it got its international release, Grapevine will have spread the word that it's not such a great film. So probably if you compared the international box offices, which again, I know is not information that we've been able to find, but that's probably where the drop off is in the international market rather than the North American market, because people will have just rushed out and seen it because the first movie was so great.
Yeah. And the time the reviews and stuff come out, like print press was worldwide by then. So people would have looked up charts and billboards and they would have been printed overseas and stuff. And because the first film was such an success, foreign press would have been covering the release of the sequel. But talking about press,
which is another reason that it's weird to stagger the release so badly, because by the time it comes out in the rest of the world, everyone knows it's a turkey. If you release it all kind of close together, people go and see it before they realize it's crap.
But maybe they didn't think it was a turkey. Maybe they were like, this is a surefire.
Maybe they thought it was a really good movie.
Yeah.
Do you think they thought it was a good movie?
Well, the thing is, the first one, so let's look before I mention the Rotten Tomatoes scores for this movie, the first movie had criminal scores, because revisiting it, I watched the first one as well.
Yeah, and me too.
The first movie had Rotten Tomatoes scores currently sitting at critics is 55% and audience is 47%. So when this movie came out, the first movie came out, we would have had critic scores. They would have when the Rotten Tomato came out as well, they would have republished old articles back in the day in 1989. But all these audience scores are new audience scores since Rotten Tomatoes has been around. So even now, audience still think it's a 47% scoring movie. Well, I still think it's pretty criminal.
The first movie.
I think it's fantastic. The chemistry between Kirstie Alley and John Travolta is palpable.
It's palpable.
I just made that word up. Palpable. Yeah, I just made a word up.
Palpable.
Palpable. That's a word.
So exciting he can't speak.
It's 8:30 a.m. for me.
No, it's fine. It's fine. Don't worry.
I do think that their chemistry in the first movie is probably one of my favourite on-screen couples. Like, it's comparable to Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell in Overboard. Do you know? It's there's so much chemistry between two people that it just oozes from the screen.
Yeah.
But the sequel, they decided to take a different route for that, instead of letting them have that chemistry carry on. And obviously, we saw something that the director and writer didn't. Because the critic score for this film has dropped further. This one is 13% critics and 32% audience. Well, I still think it's still criminal. I don't think it's a 13% movie at all.
No.
I think it's very mediocre. I think the first one's exceptional. So I'm doing it again. Yeah. I'm making up words.
Exception. How much coffee have you had? Not enough or too much?
Too much.
Too much. Too much.
Too much. Too much coffee. So, yeah. But Claire,
yes.
Do you have any behind-the-scenes stuff for us? I dread seeing this because I feel like the gleam in Claire's eye right now. She's licking her lips with content.
No, there's not a huge amount, but I found this quite interesting,
juicy.
Actually. This is quite an interesting read. I've got some tea.
Ooh, so, let's have a kiki.
In terms of cast and creative team, we've got most of the team from the first movie have carried over into the second movie. So we've got John Travolta, we've got Kirstie Alley, we've got Olympia Dukakis, we've got Twink Kaplan, we've got Bruce Willis, we've got also Neil Israel, who doesn't have a very big part in either movie, but he is in both movies, so I'm going to mention it. He plays Molly's boss in both movies. Yeah. He is, or was at the time, married to Amy Heckerling, who is the writer and director of both movies. He co-wrote on both movies. He isn't credited on the first movie, but apparently he did co-write on the first movie, and he co-wrote on the second movie. He actually also was sort of the inspiration for the whole concept. The idea of Look Who's Talking came to Amy Heckerling when she saw how he interacted with their baby daughter, who is also called Molly, because I guess that's the point at which her imagination ran out of ideas. So she named the character after her daughter anyway. But he used to, as baby Molly was pottering around the house being a baby and being a toddler, Neil Israel would kind of put on funny baby voices and narrate her life as her. And so that's how this concept of the story being told through the baby's point of view with the voiceover kind of came to fruition. So that's why I'm giving him a bit more of a mention than you normally would give someone who has essentially a cameo in the two movies. In terms of new cast, you've got Elias Koteas coming in as Stuart, Molly's brother. We've got Roseanne Barr is the big new cast member who voices Julie. Now, in the first movie, Julie appears very briefly at the end of the first movie, and she's voiced by Joan Rivers in an uncredited role, but she wasn't available to do the voice in the second movie. So they cast Roseanne Barr, who obviously at the time was quite a big name. Damon Wayans, massive mistake casting Roseanne.
Well, I understand why they did it, because she was more popular at the time due to the sitcom. But I think I would have preferred to see here Joan Rivers doing more off the cuff.
100%. Times,
off the
cuff. Absolutely.
She would have done things like off the comments, because they obviously voiced the baby after, because in this one.
Yeah, so the children's voiceovers were mostly improvised based on what the children did.
I
agree with you. I think Joan Rivers would have been amazing. It would have been much more acerbic, I think, from Joan Rivers, because that was her humour. With Roseanne, everything's very deadpan.
Yes.
Which kind of works. It's okay. I don't mind it, but it would have been a lot sharper, I think, if we'd had Joan Rivers in that role. We've got Damon Wayans being Eddie, which is a part that originally was going to be covered by Richard Pryor. He was going to voice that role, but he had to pull out due to ill health. Yeah. So he had his second heart attack in early 1990s. So I'm guessing that's the reason why he couldn't be in this movie. But he did do a bit of early voice work on it. And some of the early trailers for this movie used his voiceover. But then the movie, it was Damon Wayans. Yeah. And then we've got Gilbert Gottfried in one of the weirdest bits of casting I think I've ever seen in any movie ever, perhaps. Gilbert Gottfried as the guy that runs Baby Gym. What the actual fuck? I love Gilbert Gottfried. Don't get me wrong. We've talked about him before because he was in Return of Jafar. So we talked about how much we love Gilbert Gottfried. And I do love him. But I would not take my child to a baby club run by Gilbert Gottfried. You just wouldn't. It's weird casting. And he was nominated for a Razzie for this piece,
actor. I think the Razzies are a load of bullshit anyway, but this is ridiculous. He's on screen. He's a cameo. He's not even... He got nominated for Best Supporting Actor. And I was like, this is a cameo. This is not even a supporting actor.
It's not a supporting actor. It's a cameo. And also...
He's a supporting character.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, Gilbert Gottfried, what you got from him is what you would expect to get from him. It's not like he went in and turned in a bad performance. He turned in exactly the performance that he was presumably hired for, because that's what he does in every movie he's ever in. I would just question the decision to cast him. Maybe, I guess they maybe thought it was funny, a funny little juxtaposition against the softness, I guess, of John Travolta, particularly in the scene where they're dancing together. Yeah. Maybe. I don't know.
But even Roseanne Barr was nominated for Worst Supporting Actress for the Razzies as well that year. So I was a bit for this, and I was a bit like, she's not even on screen. She's doing a voiceover, and that's ridiculous.
Like, I didn't think she was bad either.
She wasn't.
As you said, I think Joan Rivers would have been better. But exactly. She gave exactly the performance that you would expect from Roseanne Barr. We've also got a little cameo from Mel Brooks doing the voice of Mr. Toilet
Love
Man
him.
In one of Baby Mikey's fever dreams.
Love him.
So the movie was directed by Amy Heckerling, as I mentioned earlier. She directed both movies, and she produced on Look Who's Talking Now. She did not direct Look Who's Talking Now. She also did not write Look Who's Talking Now, but she wrote both of these movies. She co-wrote with Neil Israel. Amy Heckerling also wrote and directed Clueless a few years later, and Neil Israel also wrote Police Academy. So just to give a bit of background on what else they've worked at.
Yeah.
In terms of the production process for this movie, as you said, it was a very quick turnaround from the release of the first movie to the release of the second movie. I had always assumed that these movies were made back to back because they were released 14 months, I think, apart for the American releases. And it was going to end up being roughly the same for the worldwide release as well. But that's not the case. The first movie was made. TriStar, who was a production company, they obviously optioned everyone for sequels because you always do, but they weren't necessarily expecting to take up the option. And then they saw the success of the first movie and they instantly greenlit the sequel. So the sequel was greenlit before the overseas release of the first movie. So before the movie was released in the UK and Europe, the sequel was already in production, having not been planned at all. So it's a very, very quick turnaround to green light, to storyboard, write the movie, make the movie. Really, really quick. The original idea, like I said, came from Amy Heckerling, was inspired by seeing her husband playing with their daughter. She then pitched the movie. So she pitched the movie to Disney. Disney turned it down because they felt that the content was too mature. There was too much sexual content, even for releasing it as a Touchstone movie. They weren't interested. Paramount weren't interested. Warner Brothers, Orion, 20th Century Fox, Universal Studios, they all passed on this movie. And then it was TriStar who originally picked it up and greenlit it with, as you said, a $7 million budget. The focus was put very much on the baby character and the Bruce Willis role, particularly in the early trailers were really focused on the Mikey character, because although Kirstie Alley and John Travolta were big names, they were both in a bit of a slump at that point in the 80s. So the studio were a bit nervous about putting too much emphasis on them, particularly John Travolta, because although he'd had that great success at the end of the 70s, the first 4 or 5 years of the 80s had been a bit of a drop for him. He'd had quite a few kind of flops on the bounce. The studio were really nervous about casting him. They almost didn't cast him, but they did. And thank goodness they did. And then once the studio saw how much people enjoyed watching their performance together, they then in subsequent trailers kind of amped up their position in the trailer and they became much more prominent.
I think the reason why it worked quite well is because and the reason why John Travolta had a slump in the mid 80s was because he went from doing things like Harry and Saturday Night Fever and that young, attractive kind of like sex symbol look, and then tried doing a few action movies, and then he, by him becoming the dad in this movie or the sexy single guy that's attracted to the single mum, he's appealing to that audience that grew up watching Grease.
Yes.
So I think that for whole sure. woman, and I think that's the reason it worked. So I think that's the reason why the studio was, they were hesitant, but I think it worked for them because the audience that is attracted to John Travolta's not an action star.
But these are the sorts of roles that really suit him, that kind of cheeky kind of cute, funny guy. And actually he said at the time that this is, of all the roles he's played, this is the one that's most like him in terms of the character. So it, and you can see that it suits him, the character comes to him so naturally. It kind of seems mad now on reflection that he ever wasn't in the running for the role. Do you want to hear who else was considered for this role?
Yeah, go ahead, go.
It's bonkers. So John Stamos was the first choice. But the producers of Full House wouldn't let him out of his contract, so he couldn't take the role. Stand by for a list of names now that is the same list of names that I always see. It doesn't matter when the movies are made or what kind of movie it is. These always seem to be the names that come up of who else was considered. Michael Keaton, Mel Gibson, Jeff Goldblum, Nicolas Cage and Kurt Russell were all considered for the role of James.
And you know who I thought you'd mention? And you didn't mention him? Tom Hanks. I thought you were going to mention Hanks. Tom Hanks.
Because he's always on the list. This is one that he wasn't in the running for. I guess he was probably busy making Big at this point.
Or he's probably just a bit too clean cut because the idea of the New York taxi driver, Tom Hanks the taxi driver.
Probably
too cut.
He might have also been too expensive. I'm trying to think of when Big came out. If Look Who's Talking came after Big, Tom Hanks might have been too expensive, possibly. I don't know. Maybe he was considered and it's just not come up in any of my research. He seems to be considered for every other role in every movie ever. So,
Big came out in 1988. So
yeah,
a few years.
So maybe he just wasn't interested in doing it. It kind of fits in the same ballpark, or maybe he was too expensive, or who knows. Gina Davis was considered for the role of Molly, but she turned it down because she didn't. She turned it down because she didn't want to do another movie in which she would have to give birth, particularly having done that in The Fly. She didn't want to go through another birthing sequence. I mean, it's slightly different, but yeah, she didn't want to do it. I think she'd have been good, but I do find it really difficult to imagine anyone other than Kirstie Alley and John Travolta in these roles, because their partnership is just... it's one off, and you wouldn't have had that chemistry with Gina Davis. I don't think she's a fantastic actress, but I just don't think it would have worked, because they wouldn't have clicked in that way. I mean, Kirstie Alley she said in her memoir that she fell in love with John Travolta when they were making Look Who's Talking. And this was always not acted on. She was married at the time, and she stayed faithful to her husband, but she completely fell in love with John Travolta making the first movie. And you can see it. You can see that there is a real life chemistry between them, as well as just performing on screen together. Alternative castings for Mikey: Chevy Chase, Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Steve Martin, John Candy. They were all considered, but they were all busy doing other things. Steve Guttenberg was considered. He turned it down. Robin Williams was considered, but he wanted too much money, double the film's production budget. And then we ended up with Bruce Willis, who I think is really good in this part. And actually, he managed to score a pretty sweet salary deal for this movie.
What, the first he only film did or this about, one?
For the first film. I imagine for the second film, it might have been slightly different. Right, but for the first film, he did about 4 days of voice work. He negotiated quite a small fee, but he also negotiated a cut of the box office, amounting to somewhere between 8 and 10% of box office. He took at least $10 million for Look Who's Talking, which is more than twice he got what he got for Die Hard.
Jesus.
So that was a very, really canny move on his part. I don't know why he did it that way. Maybe he's got a brilliant agent. Maybe he saw something in the movie that no one else saw at the time. But it was a very smart move by him to do that. Did you know there has been talk of a reboot? They've been talking about rebooting the franchise. Mm. As far back as 2010, Fast and Furious producer Neil H. Moritz was talking about rebooting the series. The concept then being that Mikey is now the grown-up.
Yeah.
But the format stays the same. So it's his kid that would feature in the movie. 2019, director Jeremy Garlick was apparently working on a script for the reboot. I mean, obviously the world has changed since then. That was pre-pandemic. It might have got shelved. I've not been able to find anything out. I'm kind of in two minds whether I want to see that reboot or not.
They can't really do the original concept about doing a sequel with Mikey as a grown-up, because people would want to see Kirstie Alley and John Travolta, and now Kirstie Alley has passed away, I don't think John Travolta want to come back to the part. So I don't think people...
Yes, that's true. It would work brilliantly if they could bring them in as cameos into it.
As
that would have been fantastic. But we've lost Kirstie Alley, we've lost Olympia Dukakis, so a lot of those cameos... I don't know. Maybe it wouldn't work. I don't know. But then they've been rebooting lots of movies from that era, either as new movies or as TV series. So maybe it will happen.
Well, I did mention to you after watching the original that I would, if they were going to do a reboot of it, I think I would like to see a reboot of, I could watch a reboot of this with Ryan Reynolds and Blake Lively. I think that I would like to see.
Yeah, I remember you said that.
I think they need to find a couple that's on screen together that would work quite well, that could do the sequel together.
Thing, you'd have to try and achieve that same level of chemistry. And to be honest, I said, when you said that to me the other day, I said to you, I appreciate that Ryan Reynolds and Blake Lively are a couple in real life.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure they would have the same chemistry of John Travolta and Kirstie Alley. Maybe part of their chemistry, actually, maybe the success of it was the fact that they weren't a couple.
Yeah.
And they had that connection and they had those feelings, but they never acted on any of it. It was always because the whole of that first movie was so will they, won't they?
Yeah.
And if they already had off screen, maybe it would change that element of it. I don't know.
But hear me out.
Go on.
Blake Lively, Ryan Reynolds, remake of Look Who's Talking, and get Mikey voiced, but the new Mikey or the new baby, voiced by Hugh Jackman. Just that would be hysterical.
I mean, it's not going to happen.
But it would be hysterical. It would be so funny because do you imagine all this? If they filmed it and then Hugh Jackman went in to do his voiceover comments, the sarcastic comments he could make about Ryan Reynolds while after filming, it would be just be so funny. And they both rely on that lean in now. It would be so good.
It would be so funny.
But yeah.
So I think that's everything. Oh, do you want the tea? I didn't spill the tea. Go on, get comfy. Grab your popcorn, kids. I feel like I might have oversold it now. Something that I learned while I was doing my research on this film, I was looking up various things and the dates, and obviously this movie was being made through 1990, basically. Yeah. Something that also happened in 1990 was that Amy Heckerling and Neil Israel divorced. So the couple who had created this franchise together and written this movie together, while they were working on this movie, presumably at the same time, their marriage was breaking up. Now, I don't know whether that influenced any of the story writing, because obviously, as you said in the first movie, it was all very romantic and it was about them getting together and that first flush of love. In this movie, Molly and James are a bit of a hot mess. Whether that is influenced by what was going on in the writer's personal life, I don't know. The other thing I found out, and this is very public knowledge, I just had never looked it up before because why would I, is that their daughter Molly, the inspiration for the whole series, is not actually Neil Israel's daughter. She is Harold Ramis's daughter.
What, from
this all came out in from Ghostbusters. Yeah, she's Egon's daughter. Yeah, this came out in 2004, I think it was. I mean, publicly anyway, whether it came out between the family earlier and whether it was a contributing factor to their divorce, I couldn't possibly comment. I have no idea. But I just found that I'm not really normally interested in delving into the kind of ins and outs of people's personal lives when I'm talking about their movies. But the fact that their personal life was such a strong inspiration for the movie makes it, for me, really interesting that actually while they were working on this second movie together, their marriage was ending. And then it then later came out that the child that had inspired the whole thing and his relationship with the child was not what they thought
But in the original movie, she has the affair. Molly has the affair with her boss, but then gets married to John Travolta. So that baby is not John Travolta. So it's kind of exactly like real life.
Yeah, I mean, she was having an affair because she was having the affair, but she wasn't the one cheating as such. It was him that was married. But still,
It's still the concept of a man bringing up somebody else's kid. What Israel was doing in real life, he was bringing up another child.
But I don't know. I mean, maybe he knew. Maybe he knew the whole time that she wasn't his
maybe
daughter.
That's why I don't know.
I don't know. But I found it really interesting that it being a project that had been so closely inspired by their family life, that actually this was all going on in the background of that. Whether that's part of the reason that this film is not so cleanly written as the first one. Couldn't possibly comment, but that's just how the timelines worked out. So Michael, tell us, what do you like in this movie?
Is that
a difficult question to answer?
Well, it is, really, because when I was younger, these were quite popular movies in our household. They were movies that we had on VHS, and there were movies that, as a kid, I didn't get that adult humour, but my parents did. It was like that had that whole Disney Pixar kind of feel where there's hidden jokes for adults, and or there's me that's just a talking baby talking about poop. And I was 10 and the original movie came out. And I think at the movie theatre, when you think to see them as a kid, they were just movies that we got from the local video store, and then we bought them on VHS when they came out for sale. And I think being a kid that always liked scary things and liked the horror aspect of movies and was more into kind of like watching scary kids movies as a kid, I really like this one more than the original one. I really like the little demon doll coming to life and the bear coming to life and talking toilet. I loved all of that. And then watching it as an adult, I was like, oh, this is problematic. All of it was pretty problematic, wasn't it? But it did really remind me of your lifestyle, because I was just kind of like, especially watching your two kids grow up and being at the end of the FaceTime when I phone you and your kids are arguing, watching this movie was very relatable to me as somebody. And it was like watching this and then watching our FaceTimes were quite similar. It was just like sibling rivalries are quite strong in this movie.
My son has never ripped the head off any of my daughter's toys. I need to be really clear on that.
That is true. Has he ever thrown them with anger?
I don't know. I mean, the thing is, half of her toys are his anyway, because I'm too tight to buy new toys for a second kid. I kept everything of his and now it's hers. So that, which then just amps up the sibling rivalry even more, because then he's like, hang on, that's my toy. Not anymore, it isn't. It's hers now.
That's so mean. But come on, if you're going to get worried about your kid having nightmares, don't show them that frigging ghost cartoon before they go to bed. I'm like, no wonder that kid's imagining monsters every 5 minutes. There's a scene in the movie where they're showing this old-fashioned black and white ghost cartoon.
Yeah.
From the 1940s or 50s. And it's freaking creepy as hell. And it's kind of up there
with Pink Elephants on Parade, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm just like, no wonder this kid's in bed going, monster under the bed. I'm like, look at the shit you're showing him before bed. I love the beginning of this movie more than I love the beginning of the original movies. I love the fact that John Travolta gets to voice Ollie Sperm, and I love that Kirstie Alley gets to voice that egg. I love it. Especially when Kirstie Alley's like, get out of here. You can't get in here.
Yeah. Although I did find it weird, before I'd clocked that it was them doing that voiceover, I was like, why are all the sperms got male voices when it's a girl baby? So then the sperms should be female voices. But then, obviously it's John Travolta and Kirstie Alley doing the voices.
Yeah, so obviously.
But I did, my little scientific brain went, but surely it's the sperm should be female sperm to make a female baby.
I think you need to leave your scientific brain. I think you need to leave a scientific brain.
This isn't the right movie for my scientific brain, is it?
No, but
they don't need to cast any more actors. They can just use the ones they've got.
But as an 8-year-old watching the original movie when I was, I think these films taught me where babies came from, because it was it's so like implanted in my brain seeing that little sperm in the original movie swimming towards the egg.
Another
kid, you're like, what's that? Like many, many things will go over a kid's head. So when the video movie came out, 8 or 9, I was probably watching that scene and having a brother who's 3.5 years older than you.
This is the movie that taught you about het sex.
Yeah. Well, would you show that opening scene to your eight-year-old son? Charlie's 8. Would you show it to him?
Mm.
Would you not ask what that is?
I thought about this when I was watching. And yes, I think I probably would. And yes, he would. He probably would ask. Well, no, I wouldn't, because I don't know. Maybe I would, maybe I wouldn't. The 12 certificate movies, the 12 A's now, but at the time, because I think Look Who's Talking, I think, was one of the first 12 certificate movies. I did see it in the cinema, even though I was 10, because I've always looked older than my age. And so I got in to see it. So this was one of the first movies I think I saw at the cinema without my parents.
Yeah.
I don't remember particularly. I remember that opening sequence, but I don't remember particularly thinking much of it. So maybe it went over my head, or maybe I knew exactly what was going on and didn't question it. I don't know if I would watch it with... I think if the movie kit was on TV, if we were channel hopping and it was on, I would let it play, perhaps. I don't think I would sit down and say, it's time for you to watch Look Who's Talking. More about the language, though, than about the opening sequence, because it is very... it's a biological fact. You don't see anything sexual happening.
No.
And he does know bits and pieces about where babies come from, because he knows that he grew inside my belly, and he knows that his sister grew inside my belly, and he knows how both of them got out. He hasn't asked too many questions about how they got in there, and that suits me just fine. Yeah. I don't know. I think it would probably inspire questions that I wouldn't be delighted to answer.
Yeah.
But it would be more about the language that would stop me from showing it to him than that sequence. I think he'd be quite easily distracted from that sequence. I think I could just show him something shiny and he would miss it and it would be fine.
Look over here, it's a Beanie Baby. That would distract him instantly.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, is that a Pokemon card? Oh, no, never mind.
The injection scene when she gets her injection, when she's like, and she's just like, well, the back away. I still do that voiceover in my head when I take my dogs to get their yearly vaccines and stuff. it makes me think of it every single time.
Yeah.
That's one scene that's always stayed with me. I really like the scene when John Travolta gets to do Elvis around the playgroup.
Yeah. Well, that was clearly thrown in for the mums, wasn't it? That is very much for the mums.
I'm now at that age where I find people...
And the middle-aged gay guys.
And who at the time was, I used to be like, oh, John Travolta. I'm at that age where I find people attractive that my mother found attractive when I was younger, and I used to be repulsed by them. So kind of like young John Travolta, young Harrison Ford, young Tom Hanks. Now I'm like, oh, I get it now.
Yeah, same.
At the time, I'm like,
same.
Ew.
And but particularly like, in this Harrison movie. Ford,
oh. Yeah.
Okay. I think particularly in this movie with John Travolta, though, it really is tapping into that something for the mums aspect, because he's being that cheeky chappy. He's very attractive. He's giving it all the hips that, you know, that everyone fell in love with him in Grease for. But he's also being a good dad, which is something that women of my age find very attractive.
Is it like that, though, those 80s posters of half-naked man with long hair holding puppy?
The Athena dude. It's the Athena guy. It is. It's the same principle, isn't it? Of a hot guy looking after a baby is one of the cutest things. And it would make certainly a middle-aged het woman, or probably younger than that het woman as well, go a little bit fluttery. It's just what happens.
But it's so weird, because now if you see a hot guy who's really attractive and well-kept pushing a baby around, most straight women probably go, okay. Back then, you would just think, baby
he's
men,
the manny.
Petrol. He's the man. Or he's a gay couple, that's probably. What did you like
anything
about
else?
The movie?
What do I like? Do you know, there's a few things I like. I really like, I like the relationship between Molly and James. I don't like where the relationship has ended up in this movie. It's obviously a very strained relationship, but I like they're still really believable as a couple. And actually, I like that they've made that transition from that kind of will they, won't they thing falling in love in the first movie to now it's a very real relationship. And they're still in love. And you can see the whole way through the movie that they are still in love. But the reality of being a married couple in a city where maybe one of you isn't working and you've got two young kids, you see the pressures that puts on their relationship, and it is very real and it is very believable and it's quite relatable as well. I love the kids in the movie. I think the kid that plays Mikey is brilliant. I think the little girl that plays Julie, her facial expressions are iconic. I don't know how they managed to get these kids to perform in that way. And also the little kid in Mikey's Big Brother Dream sequence, you know, like the kid in the leather jacket that tries to rob her. And they have that little fight. And I was like, this is brilliant. I don't know how they got these kids to do this scene, because they can't have been more than three, maybe tiny 4-year-olds. The performances from those kids are great.
I got the impression also that they gave Mikey lights because his mouth moves a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And then Bruce Willis. And that annoyed me because I felt, and what he was mouthing was kind of like what Bruce was saying. So I don't know if they filmed him actually having a voice and having lines, and then they went, oh, it looks weird with him having a baby voice and Bruce Willis voice. So let's just get Bruce Willis to say those lines. Because
Yes, because in the first movie, there was no voice movement, obviously, because Mikey was pre-talking age. But then even in the second movie, Julie is pre-talking age, and there are still moments when her mouth moves while Roseanne's doing the voiceover. And it was the same with the Eddie character as well, with all of the infant characters. And that did sit weird with me. And I don't know if it was because it was different from the first movie or if it's just weird when you have kids doing weird voiceover stuff.
It probably also to do with quick production because they're trying to get the movie in the can and they didn't have time to sit there to make those kids stop talking and stuff. So like that, yeah. Move on.
And it's also probably quite tricky. I say this as someone who lives with a 4-year-old to get them to perform scenes without speaking. The kids were probably chatting quite a lot because that's what they do. Once they found their voices, it's like a stream of consciousness. So I think it would have been quite hard for them to have captured them doing whatever actions they needed to be doing without them also vocalizing. But I did find it weird that even with Julie then, I suppose maybe they were trying to make it a continuity because that's what they were doing with the older kids. But I found that a bit weird and a bit, it put me off a little bit. But the voiceovers, I think, given that it was mostly improvised, I presume there was some sort of rough structure of what the characters needed to be saying. But most of Bruce Willis and Roseanne Barr's dialogue was completely improvised. And I think you can see the little moments where it's, you know, he's responding to something that the kid has done. And it really works. So I love that in the first movie and in this movie. Olympia Dukakis is just a queen. Love her.
Yeah.
Underused in this movie. I think I would have liked to have seen more from her. I would have liked to have seen more from Twink Kaplan as well. I really like her in both movies.
Miss her.
But I felt like in this movie she was there a lot, but she was just there to help make other things happen. I didn't feel like she really had her own story.
She was just shoehorned in. Like she was there at work and then she was there to go, my apartment got broken in to make you aware that of the burglar out and about. That lead to the finale.
Yeah, she's Chekhov's best mate, isn't she? She's just there to help make things happen further in the movie, which is a shame because I really like her. And she was very good in the first movie. Yeah. And I would have liked to have seen more of her being the character rather than just being a conduit for other things. Yes.
Yes.
So what don't you like?
Don't like the very thin plot. Let's just get that out there. I think there's a...
I think plot is a very generous word to be used.
A collection of ideas shoved together. I know this went into production quick, and I don't understand how you can have the same writer, same cast, and same director, and it be this substandard from the original movie.
Yeah.
And it's a year later, there's still lots of buzz out there. The first movie only came out on VHS rental in 1990, what was the year of this release? This came out in October. So there's probably still a wall of it in Blockbuster. And I was just a bit like, the world must have been buzzing still. How did this film not work? There was a much better movie to be told. Like, I know that you and me had a conversation off microphone about this, about how I would have liked to have seen a movie maybe about her being... having Julie at the end of the first one, not recapping that, but then having the two kids and then planning a wedding, what would give them more work for Olympia Dukakis to be involved and her best friend to be involved and the uncle coming in, but as he could come in as John Travolta's brother and being a best man, it would have worked better.
Absolutely.
To have.
And the timeline would have worked as well. I found the timeline in this movie
100%
really weird because she said to her friend, we've been together 18 months. And by this stage, I'm sure this happens after we've seen Julie sitting up, which would suggest that Julie's at least 6 months old. So Julie was born about a year after they got together, which then suggests that between the end of the first movie and the following 3-month period, they got married and then conceived Julie. Now, obviously, Julie's conception wasn't necessarily planned, but even still, to go from not together to being married in the space of 3 months, because we know that when Julie's conceived, they're already married. That's really fast. I know it's possible. It is possible, but it seems very unlikely. And for someone who is quite sensible, for a character like Molly, who is quite sensible.
Yes.
It seems unlikely that she would go from not being in a relationship with someone to marrying someone when she'd been looking for this stable family home for her son. It doesn't quite add up for me. And I think you're right. I think if they'd if they'd done it so that the plot of the movie was the wedding, there'd be more scope for comedy. There's obviously scope still for conflict, yeah, if that's what they wanted. But there's something to construct a movie around. I think that's the issue with this movie. And I think I think you hit the nail on the head about it, you know, the fact that it was rushed out. They didn't want to make the movie. Amy Heckerling didn't want to make this movie. She was contractually obliged to. She felt like she told the story that she wanted to tell in the first movie. So they went into this with a really tight time frame to make a movie and no movie. They had no concept. They had no storyline. They had no idea. And so I guess they must have, there must have been a degree of piecing it together as they go. Because with that kind of time scale, starting from completely blank page on your notebook, how do you make the movie in 14 months? And it really shows in this movie how rushed it is, because so much happens in this movie, even though there's no plot. It's weird.
But it's just also weird. It's weird to have a post-credit scene in the original movie.
Yes.
But then backtrack. Like nine months before.
That didn't bother me so much, that they then went back further from the beginning of the movie than you'd seen at the end.
That's weird to me.
But then there were so many continuity weirdnesses between those two scenes, because I think at the end of the first movie, James brings Mikey in to meet Julie. They're the only ones there, whereas in the sequel, there are other visitors in the hospital who are on their way out of the room as James is bringing Mikey in. James has got a fucking bandage on his head in the sequel that wasn't there in the first movie. Didn't need to be there in the second movie. I don't know why.
Yeah.
I mean, that scene was comedy. As someone who's had a C-section, that whole scene was comedy where he passed out. Because one of the few things I remember from my cesarean was my 6'6" husband being kind of shuffled into this room, because it was an emergency section for me. So everything happened really quickly. And he was just kind of, we had this tiny little operating theatre, and they just shoved him in the corner of the room and went, sit there, don't faint. Because there just wasn't space for him to pass out on the floor with everything else that had, and he didn't, bless him. Thank you very much, Chris. He did not faint during my section. But I did appreciate the comedy of that scene. You can see how rushed this movie is, because they didn't take the time to join up any of those dots. And it's frustrating. That's the thing, my kind of remaining feeling about this movie is frustration, because it could have been so good, because the first one is so good and it's all the same people. There's no reason why they couldn't replicate it. I just wish the studio had given them a bit more time, and I think they probably could have done it. This is the thing. It's like, oh, and here's, so I said this to you actually after I watched the movie. We got to the reconciliation in the plane between Molly and James. And we got to the point that we're like, oh, okay, it's fine. They're going to get back together. It's all going to be fine. It's the end of the movie. Oh, no, but it isn't the end of the movie, because we've got the whole burglary thing, a whole thing that, yes, there was a throwaway thing earlier in the movie about Rona's house getting broken into, but that didn't need to be there. And this whole scene didn't need to happen. We didn't need the burglary. We didn't need the fire. Other than the fact that this is a really short movie. It's an 80-minute movie, including credits. And clearly they needed stuff to fill the movie. Otherwise, it's not a movie. It's just a long TV show, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I guess that's why all this other stuff was put in there. But it's a collection of stuff. It's not a movie. There's no story to it, really. It's just a collection of scenes.
Yeah,
there is a linear path through, but it's not cohesive.
The thing is, the biggest storyline in this sequel is Rona and the brother getting together, because the other storylines we consist of is Molly and John Travolta's character, James. They break up and get back together again. Nothing big. Whoop! They did it twice in the first movie, and Mikey learned how to potty. Mikey learned how to go potty, and Judy learned how to crawl. That's all that happened in this movie.
Yeah.
And I was like,
yeah.
Where's the rest of the story? Like, I know I sound like I am bitching about this movie, but I still had a good time.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't mind the hour and 20 minutes I gave this movie at all. I don't begrudge it that small amount of my time. Mm-hmm. But I do come out of it feeling frustrated that actually I would rather have had a longer gap between the movies and them had time to develop something. Because I see how good the first movie is, and I see how good the second movie could have been.
Yeah, I feel like
if it had the kind of time.
I feel like the characters were cheated.
Yes. And also, I felt like Molly was a bit of a dick in the second movie.
Oh, 100%.
I really loved Molly as a character. In the first movie, I was really like, she's a really strong, independent woman, apart from the fact that she's kind of been caught up in this really bullshit affair that she's kind of on the hook with this guy. But, you know, nobody's perfect. She was she was a strong, independent woman. She'd got her own career. She'd got her own apartment. She found herself pregnant unexpectedly, and she dealt with it. And she booted that guy out once she'd realised exactly how the land was lying. She ditched him. She, you know, I want to find a father for my kid. No, you're not good enough. You're not good enough. You're not good enough. She really knew who she was and what she was doing with herself. And then in the second movie, I felt like she was really watered down, and she was really... And yes, you do change once you've had a couple of kids. You do change as a personality, but I just felt like not to that extent. She was such a dick to James, and he was a dick back to her. You're being sarcastic now, aren't you, about me?
No, I wouldn't do that.
I felt like her character was cheated, and James. I just felt like they were turned into people that they weren't in the first movie in order to create the conflict.
Yeah,
for the second movie,
we didn't need a
which then made the conflict feel unnatural. We didn't need conflict. Yes, you can't just rehash the same movie again, but I don't know.
But that's the whole thing, though. They kind of did, because there's a section in the first movie where they don't speak and they break up, and then she chases after him. In the sequel, they break up and then she chases after him. It's the same. I would have preferred them to be happy, then plan a wedding, and then something. Then he backs off and goes, "Your parents are overbearing. Your parents are taking control of this wedding, and it's not the wedding I want."
Oh, yeah. And then there was that thing where he was like, "Oh, no, I'm pissed off because your parents do our taxes." Like, where did that come from an hour into the movie? Suddenly there's conflict with his in-laws that we've not mentioned before.
Like, that would have been so more realistic for couples to be in that position, to have a conflict with interfering mother-in-laws while planning a wedding, and it's not the wedding he wants. And
at the end of it, well, we've all seen My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
Yeah. So that would have made more sense to have that kind of impact, you know? So, apart from that, is there anything else you don't like about the movie, Claire?
I think we've covered it. I'm just looking back through my notes. A lot of it is stuff that we've covered. Yeah. It's not terrible. It's just, it's
blah.
A mess, isn't it? Yeah.
So in that case, Claire, how many... bouncing babies would you give Look Who's Talking To?
Well, tying in neatly with my own life, I am going to give it 2 bouncing babies out of 5. I think...
Really?
What, you think that's high or you think that's low?
I think that's low.
You think that's low? Well, the thing is, I 2 is only just under half, isn't it? It's like, it's just slightly below middling movie for me. The thing is, there's a lot in it I enjoyed. There were moments of it that I really enjoyed. I laughed out loud a couple of times. And not just at Kirstie Alley doing her demon voice in Labour, which was brilliant, by the way. very relatable. I just think this movie doesn't do anything. It doesn't serve any kind of purpose. It doesn't serve the characters. It doesn't go anywhere. And as entertaining as it is, I don't think it's entertaining enough to justify its existence just on the basis of it being entertaining. It needs a bit more of something to it, really, to qualify as a good movie for me. Yeah. So for me, it's, I don't mind watching it. I will never object to watching it. If I'm with someone who wants to watch it, I will never say, no, I'm not watching that. If I'm channel hopping and it's on, I will probably sit and watch it quite happily. But it's not a good movie. So, for me, it's a 2 out of 5. What about you?
Well, you're in line with the audience. The audience gave it 32%. So, like, the audience want to make their score. So
so I'm a nudge over that. But, yeah.
Yeah.
Critics can get in the sea, though, with their 13%.
Yeah, that's not fair. I would give it 3 because I still find it funny. I still like seeing the characters on screen, even though they don't get the justification that I hope they would get.
Ooh, so That's Look Who's Talking To for you. Listeners, please take a moment to rate us and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any new episodes. And tell us what you thought of Look Who's Talking To. You can leave us a comment. You can email us on unlovedsequels@gmail.com and you can find us on all the socials at Unloved Sequels.
So it's goodbye from me, Michael.
And from me, Claire.
Take care, guys. Bye!
Hey, should probably be a little knocked out from the shot, so... No driving or operating heavy machinery, huh?
I'm only one, and I know that's not funny. What's that?
Oh, God, I can't watch this part.
Oh, my God!
Smarts, does it? Hurts just a little?
Will this pain ever go away?
Maybe it will. Maybe it won't.